History had once more been returned. A few months after Yakovlev's announcement, I had a chance to see glimpses of the worst nightmare of those who had once dreamed of an eternal Soviet empire. In early October 1989, Gorbachev visited Berlin, ostensibly to help celebrate the anniversary of East German statehood. The cracks in the wall were already visible. Thousands of East Germans were fleeing across border points for West Germany, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Austria. But the East German leader, Erich Honecker, was as obstinate as any of the Eastern European dictators. He was the sort of tyrant who could begin a proclamation, "If I die..." He had every intention of outlasting Gorbachev and the pressure to change. To make himself understood, Honecker orchestrated a grand ceremony of state in Gorbachev's presence. A day of speech-making in the main government palace. A goose-stepping military parade. Fireworks. One night, tens of thousands of the Party Youth League members marched through the streets of Berlin carrying flaming torches and singing songs of socialist brotherhood. In a few weeks, they'd be marching through the Berlin Wall to buy steaks and singing praises of the gods Nike and Reebok. The Berlin visit was one of Gorbachev's finest moments, the sort of subtle exchange that he was made for. A year later, when blunt decisiveness was needed at home, when democratic politics demanded an end to backroom maneuvering, Gorbachev would hesitate and fail. Boris Yeltsin would fill the vacuum. But Gorbachev was the man for this moment. In public, he played along nicely with the East German leadership. In his own speeches and comments, he never drifted far from his host. He kissed Herr Honecker firm on the lips. But in the end, that kiss was the kiss of farewell. In private, Gorbachev hinted broadly that the leadership could either begin its own massive reforms or end up defeated and defunct. Gorbachev trotted out one of his favorite aphorisms for the occasion: "Life itself punishes those who delay." He repeated it here and there, and his spokesman made sure to emphasize it at a press conference. Such hints can spark a revolution. As the East German folk singer and dissident Wolf Biermann said of Gorbachev's phrase, "The tritest commonplaces, launched into the world at the right moment, become magic spells." Many factors led to the collapse of the East German regime: the action along the border, dissension in the ruling Politburo, the rise of opposition groups. But Gorbachev's hint surely let the people know where the Kremlin, the center of the empire, stood. Within hours after he left for Moscow, an uprising had begun. Angry confrontations between demonstrators shouting, "Freiheit! Freiheit!" and the Stasi police on the Alexanderplatz. According to reports on the radio, the demonstrations were far bigger in Leipzig. Erich Honecker may not have been listening to Gorbachev, but the people of East Germany were. On November 9th, just 1 month after Gorbachev's visit, the Berlin Wall collapsed. To live anywhere between Bonn and Moscow in 1989 was to be witness to a year-long political fantasy. You had the feeling you could wander into history on the way to the bank or the seashore. Esther and I had bought cheap tickets to Prague for Thanksgiving week, thinking we'd have time to see the city and some friends and relax. There was little chance of that. The day we arrived, we checked in at the hotel and walked to Wenceslas Square, where there were no fewer than 200,000 people marching for an end to the communist regime. A couple of days later, at an even bigger demonstration, I was leaning out a window watching Alexander Dubček, 50 feet away, declare his return to Prague after 2 decades of shame. Dubček's return was remarkable enough. He was the living personification of the 1968 Prague Spring. But it was even more extraordinary that he now seemed antique. The crowds roared for him when he walked out on the balcony. but the enthusiasm faded steadily as they listened to him. His was still the old dream of socialism with a human face. The tens of thousands of students who led the 1989 revolution, who were pouring into factories and bringing the workers out to join them on the city squares, looked on Dubček as a well-intentioned but slightly out-of-it grandfather. Dubček sounded as if he had been frozen in time from the moment he was arrested by the Soviet authorities in 1968. His language was still stiff, his cadences metronomic. Like Len Karpinski's articles, Dubček's speech could not quite dispense with the Communist Party habit of euphemism, pomposity, and cliché. By the time he finished that day on Wenceslas Square, the applause was only polite. With each demonstration, Vaclav Havel's voice grew more and more hoarse, but his expressions of liberty and passion transcended the dead language of the official newspapers and party pronouncements. It was as if by writing and speaking clearly, honestly, Havel helped keep alive principles and a language that would inevitably triumph over the regime. His opposition was to act outside the system, to act decently. How lucky the Czechs were to have such a voice among them! Havel was no less a hero than Sakharov or Walesa, and his greatness, like theirs, was in his absolute belief in himself and the rightness of his cause. In Prague I read a collection of letters Havel sent to his wife Olga from prison. They were filled with philosophical discussion, abstract exploration of the reasons for existence and faith. But I found myself just as moved by overhearing Havel describe the routine of prison life, his reading of Max Brod's biography of Kafka and Bellow's Herzog, his progress in English and German, his hemorrhoids, the pleasure of smoking 2 cigarettes a day and intensifying that pleasure by smoking slowly in front of a mirror, his reasons for living, his reasons for hope. Most of all, I found myself nodding with admiration at Havel's description of the insidious way the Prague regime, or the Moscow or Beijing regimes, had made language weightless by twisting it, pacifying and corrupting it. "Words that are not backed up by life lose their weight," Havel wrote, "which means that words can be silenced in 2 ways. Either you ascribe such weight to them that no one dares utter them aloud, or you take away any weight they might have, and they turn into air. The final effect in each case is silence, the silence of the half-mad man who is constantly writing appeals to world authorities while everyone ignores him, and the silence of the Orwellian citizen." A man of the theater, Havel held his press conferences on stage during those weeks of revolution. On November 24th, after Dubček's speech on the square, he and Dubček answered the nightly questions from the press at the Magic Lantern Theater, and even got into a mild debate on socialism. Dubček was all for a purified socialism, one rinsed of Stalinist deformations. A familiar Gorbachevian theme. Havel said he could no longer discuss socialism, that it was a word and idea that had been rendered meaningless. After about an hour of this meeting of the generations, Havel's brother walked on the stage, which was still set for a production of Jorinmat's play, Minotaurus. He whispered in Havel's ear. Havel smiled, a radiant smile. Dubček was talking, and Havel interrupted with a polite gesture. "The entire Politburo has resigned," Havel announced. Suddenly there was a bottle of champagne and glasses all around. Havel and Dubček rose and toasted a free Czechoslovakia. Curtain. In the epilogue a few weeks later, Havel appeared not on stage, but on state television. He was now president of Czechoslovakia. "Citizens," he declared, "your government has been returned to you." This was not theater. This was really happening. Inside the Soviet Union itself, Republican independence leaders celebrated the end of the external empire. except for Romania, where the revolution ended in bloodshed and political ambiguity, the liberation of Eastern Europe seemed almost effortless. But they were careful not to let themselves believe that their own freedom would come soon. The Kremlin gave them every reason to think otherwise. Writing in Sovetskaya Kultura, the Kremlin's arch-spokesman, Gennady Gerasimov, said that the West was showing malignant pleasure in the Baltic independence movements. "Such movements," he wrote ominously, "threaten our reforms and are provoking use of the iron fist." In early 1990, after the string of revolutions in Eastern Europe had come to an end, an American historian, Eric Foner, conducted a seminar with his history students at Moscow State University. Foner was a specialist in the American Civil War, and the afternoon I sat in on his class, he and his students discussed the parallels between Gorbachev and Lincoln and their quests to keep together a union. For a while, Foner and his students compared the two leaders. But soon the students began to talk about what they thought their country would look like in a few years. Every one of them predicted collapse, and every one was frightened that the old regime would resist to the end. The Soviet Union is a great empire, and we are now watching its disintegration, Igor, a student from Byelorussia, said. Assuming that by my early 30s I have not been killed in a civil war, I think what will be left will be Russia, the original core territory. And that is what happened to the Roman Empire, isn't it? It shrank. I just hope that it all happens without haste and peacefully. I'm frightened, said another student, a Russian, Alexander Petrov. Power is still in the hands of the Communist Party and the KGB. They can stir it all up if they want. And if there is violence, they'll say they had to do it all to preserve peace. Their fears and visions of the future differed, but all of Foner's students fully expected the Union to collapse. The old regime, Petrov said, is not just old. It's dead. As I traveled around the Union, opinions varied on when and where the old regime died. Uzbeks in Tashkent and Samarkand told me that the exposure in around 1988 and 1989 of the callous way Moscow had turned all of Central Asia into a vast cotton plantation, in the process destroying the Aral Sea and nearly every other area of the economy, was the turning point. In the Baltic states, the official discovery of the secret protocols to the Nazi-Soviet Pact was the key moment. But it was in Ukraine that I found the most unifying event, the absolute metaphor for the explosion of the last empire on earth. On a trip to the western Ukrainian city of Lvov in 1989, I met a small group of nationalists who promised that one day their republic of over 50 million people, the biggest after Russia, would strike out for independence and do far more damage to the Union than the tiny Baltic states ever could. They knew their history. For us, Lenin once wrote, to lose the Ukraine would be to lose our head. Bogdan and Mikhail Horin, brothers who had spent long terms in jail for their pro-independence activities before Gorbachev took power, said that while an independent post-Soviet Ukraine may be years off, the old regime collapsed, practically and metaphorically, at 1:23 a.m., April 26, 1986. The moment of the nuclear accident at Chernobyl. That devastating instant had from the start been wrapped in a mystical aura. Within weeks of the accident, people realized that Chernobyl meant wormwood, and then pointed to Revelations 8:10-11. A great star shot from the sky, flaming like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and springs. The name of the star was Wormwood. And a third of the water turned to wormwood, and men in great numbers died of the water because it was poisoned. The accident at Chernobyl embodied every curse of the Soviet system, the decay and arrogance, the willful ignorance and self-deception. Before leaving for Chernobyl, I arranged to see Anatoly Alexandrov, the physicist who designed the reactor model at Chernobyl. Alexandrov was in his 90s, the dean of Soviet science. He was the former head of the Academy of Sciences and the head man at the Kurchatov Institute of Nuclear Energy. During the Brezhnev era, Alexandrov had written that nuclear power plants were 100% safe and ought to be built as close to population centers as possible, the better to solve the country's heating problems during the winter. Alexandrov's office was grander than any I had seen before, grander even than most of the palatial offices at the Kremlin. He and a group of his top aides and engineers sat in a semicircle, and he talked of the accident. No, he felt no remorse. Yes, the reactor was sound, and reports of future accidents were absurd. If there was a defect or two, we've fixed it, you see. And as for reports that hundreds, if not thousands, of people would die over the years from the effects of radioactivity unleashed at Chernobyl, Alexandrov lifted his enormous, aged hand and flapped it in derision. Oh, really now, he said. That's wild exaggeration. Stop worrying so much. There remains every reason to worry. The Chernobyl explosion released a radioactive cloud 10 times more deadly than the radiation following the blast at Hiroshima. There were children in the region who absorbed radiation equivalent to 1,000 chest X-rays. More than 600,000 workers took part in the cleanup, a deadly job. More than 200,000 people were evacuated from the region, but only after a 36-hour delay and after absorbing dangerous amounts of radioactivity. There are thousands of people in Ukraine, Byelorussia, and other republics who eat food grown in radioactive earth and drink contaminated water. At the Petrovsky Collective Farm in Narodichi, the farm directors reported that 64 farm animals were born with serious deformities in 1987. Calves without heads, limbs, ribs, eyes. Pigs with abnormal skulls. In 1988, the rate continued to rise. They recalled only 3 or 4 such instances before the accident. Moscow News said that the radiation readings in the area were 30 times greater than normal, but that local farm animals were still fed fodder from the contaminated fields. People in the region received 35 rubles a month from the state as a subsidy, money the people called the coffin bonus. The various bureaucracies seemed not to care about or believe in the perils of radiation. As late as 1990, more than 180 tons of contaminated meat were shipped to stores in Siberia and northern Russia from a processing plant in Bryansk, where the sausage was being made from beef and pork with radiation levels 10 times normal. Chernobyl was not like the communist system. They were one and the same, said Yuri Shcherbak, a physician and journalist who led the fight in Ukraine to publicize the medical and ecological hazards of the accident. The system ate into our bones the same way radiation did, and the powers that be, or the powers that were, did everything they could to cover it all up, to wish it all away. From the moment that the engineers in the control room of reactor number 4 at Chernobyl reported a disaster beyond imagining, their superiors refused to act. The top bureaucrats at Chernobyl kept repeating the same fiction, that there had been a mishap, but nothing terrible. The reactor had not been destroyed. They quickly passed on this fiction to the leadership in Moscow. The next day, the people of Chernobyl, Pripyat, and the neighboring villages acted out their lives under a radioactive cloud. Children played soccer in radioactive dust. There were 16 outdoor weddings sponsored by the Young Communist League. Old men fished in a contaminated river and ate the contaminated fish. When he was told by his engineers that the radiation at the plant was millions of times higher than normal, the plant director, Viktor Bryuchinov, said the meter was obviously defective and must be thrown away. For more than a day, Boris Cherbina, a deputy prime minister, refused suggestions to carry out a mass evacuation. Panic is worse than radiation, he said. The world got word of the seriousness of the accident only when Scandinavian scientists reported dramatic increases in radiation levels. Even as they were evacuating their own families, Ukrainian Communist Party officials insisted on holding the annual May Day parade. The children of Kiev kicked up radioactive dust to celebrate the victories of socialism. After a long filibuster in the Politburo and strict controls on public information about the disaster, Gorbachev went on television to discuss Chernobyl a full 16 days after the accident, and much of his talk was taken up with denunciations of the Western press. Meanwhile, the reactor was burning away, wrote Grigory Medvedev, an engineer who once worked at Chernobyl. The graphite was burning, belching into the sky millions of curies of radioactivity. However, the reactor was not all that was finished. An abscess, long hidden within our society, had just burst. The abscess of complacency and self-flattery, of corruption and protectionism, of narrow-mindedness and self-serving privilege. Now, as it rotted, the corpse of a bygone era, the age of lies and spiritual decay, filled the air with the stench of radiation. In the aftermath of the accident, Shcherbina, the deputy prime minister, issued a secret decree in force from 1988 to 1991, telling Soviet doctors they could not cite radiation as a cause of death. Shcherbina, who had himself been exposed to high doses of radiation, died in 1990. The cause of death was marked unspecified. One morning in Kiev, an official from Spetsatom, one of the cleanup bureaucracies, picked me up in a van and we drove north for Chernobyl. I had visited cities that were often described as frozen in time. Havana, with its faded hotels from the era of gambling and Batista. Rangoon, with its stopped clocks, reworked English cars, and the battered English silver at the Strand Hotel downtown. Usually it was a matter of faded colonialism matched against the poverty of the native regime. Chernobyl was something else again, a kind of ruin of the Soviet system, a horrible metaphor for the era that began with the revolution in 1917 and was now ending. We passed a series of checkpoints, changed into a dirty radioactive van, and headed into the haunted zone. In the town of Pripyat, there were abandoned apartment buildings, dilapidated as any other buildings in the Soviet Union. The workers and administrators of the power plant lived there. It was a moonscape of abandoned playgrounds, half-buried cars, buses, railroad wagons, abandoned fields. After the accident, people desperate for cash would dig up the buried cars and sell the radioactive parts, or just drive the whole car off to Kiev. I met older people who had been evacuated but now had come back to the zone to live and die. They had never believed anything the state had told them. And why should they begin now? They drank poisoned tea and ate poisoned potatoes. A few hundred yards away was reactor number 4, now encased in layers of concrete. Engineers were still trying to work out how they would finally eliminate the near-eternal danger posed by the core. The concrete would not hold forever. Most of the people still living in the zone were cleanup workers, and most of them stayed inside, working for 15 days, and then went home to Kiev and other towns for 15 days of recuperation. That was the rule. But there were also some who were so dedicated to the cleanup project that they rarely left the zone except to visit family for a day or two every month. The Spetsatom director, Yuri Solomenko, and the chief engineer, Viktor Golubyev, spent nearly all their time in the zone and vowed to stay on until the sarcophagus, the nickname for reactor number 4, was cleaned out. Once, while I was interviewing the two men, Golubyev excused himself. He had another meeting. As soon as he left the room, Solomenko told me his friend was all but finished. After getting news of the Chernobyl accident while working at a reactor site in Cuba, Golubyov had volunteered to help put out the fire. In those rescue operations, he absorbed so much radiation that his skin turned deep brown and had to be peeled away. Solomenko explained that his friend's body had been utterly degraded. And yet he would not leave Chernobyl until the damage was cleared away. Chernobyl was like everywhere else in this empire, Yuri Shcherbak said. The only thing that stood between us and total oblivion was a few good people, a few heroes who told the truth and risked their lives. If it weren't for the danger, they should leave the Chernobyl plant standing. It could be the great monument to the Soviet Empire. Chapter 16. The Island. I met a free man on the island of Sakhalin. His name was Nikolai Batyukov, a would-be intellectual turned itinerant fisherman, and he knew only vaguely of the political fervor thousands of miles to the west in Moscow. He did not have much to say about Gorbachev or Yeltsin or any other figure in the political life of the capital. As you can see, I keep my distance, he said. Batyukov was one of the few men or women I had encountered in Russia who seemed at ease with what he had made of his life. He was in his 50s, and many years before he had been, in the loose Russian sense, an intellectual, a serious student. But he saw no future at all in a life of the mind. Not in this country, not in the Soviet Union. He gave it all up to live as a half-legal, independent fisherman. In this country the only way to be free was to run away from it, he said. I couldn't run to Tokyo, so I ran for the hills. In the warmer months, Batyukov set up camp in the pine woods overlooking the Sea of Okhotsk, a landscape as jagged and beautiful as the coast of northern California. He fished mainly for salmon and spiny crab, and sold his catch at markets in the capital city, Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk. Batyukov had a hermit's wild gray beard, and today he said he felt more worn out than usual. All day he had been hauling nets heavy with salmon. It was the summer run. There were more fish around than he could possibly catch. What made him furious was to see the government nets, the nets set out along the shore by the state fishing boats, filled with rotting fish, big, glorious salmon going gray and belly up, while the captains idled at sea, waiting for Moscow to give them the order to bring the fish on board. Those fishing nets held at least 150,000 pounds of salmon, Batyukov reckoned. But because the local bureaucrats had to wait for orders from the central bureaucrats of the central command system, a million-dollar catch would soon be little more than rotting guts, bones, and scales. "Can you imagine anything so stupid?" he said. As if to make his guests taste the loss, Batyukov set out one of the most splendid seafood feasts I have ever eaten. He cooked it all outside over a fire, in dented tin pots and an ancient fry pan. He worked with speed and skill. He was the 15-minute gourmet. There was a fish soup as fine as any in Marseille, a mound of steamed spiny crabs, glossy red salmon caviar smeared on fresh bread, glasses of home-brewed vodka, and mugs of hot chaga, a chocolatey tea made from the sap of birch trees. Most people in the Soviet Union got fat on bad sausage, potatoes, and butter. Batyukov had clearly built his magnificent pot on finer things. "I live the way I want to live," he said, "but the only way I do it is to keep low and out of sight. In your country, I'd be a worker, maybe a businessman. Here I'm like an outlaw fisherman. So sure, I like what I'm hearing on the radio about Sakharov and Glasnost. Fine. But I'll believe it when I can see it. Tell me, you've been in Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk. Do you figure everything's different? You figure there's a place for a free man like me?" In 1890, Chekhov left behind his literary triumphs in Moscow and traveled by rail and riverboat to the prison colonies and fishing villages on Sakhalin. "This seems to be the end of the world," he wrote in his journal as he approached the coastline, "and there is nowhere else left to go." In Chekhov's day, Sakhalin was Russia's Australia, a penal colony so distant that it seemed the very definition of exile. The camps were places of arbitrary cruelty and violence. One prisoner finally murdered a sadistic guard by suffocating him in fermenting bread dough. Working conditions were miserable. Migrant coal workers ate candles and rotten wood, while the Tsar's ministers sold the island's salmon and caviar abroad. Chekhov visited Sakhalin to work as a census taker, to talk with prisoners and vagrants, and to write a long and strangely dispassionate account of life there, the island. Sakhalin seemed to him as remote as Patagonia. Sakhalin, for Chekhov, was as much an idea as a place, a representation of Russia's vastness and the Tsar's reach across it. In his census, he discovered a people who took on names that somehow reflected their remoteness and conditions. The most common surname is Nepomniachtchi, unremembered. Here are some of the vagrants' names. Mustafa Nepomniachtchi, Vasily Bezatechestva, without parents, Franz Nepomniachtchi, Ivan Nepomniachtchi, 20 years, Yakov Bezpozvanya, nameless, vagrant Ivan, 35 years. The Tsar's prison camps closed long ago. Stalin favored the slightly closer but less accessible Kolyma region as his favorite murder site. The Soviet regime did what it could to Sovietize Sakhalin, building squat, shabby apartment houses in Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk and crabbed collective farms in the ports and provinces. The government populated the island by offering extra pay for miners, fishermen, and farmers. Sakhalin was considered a border frontier, and so, until just a few months before my visit in the summer of 1989, the island was closed to foreigners and even to non-resident Soviet citizens. Even when I was there, Sakhalin was covered with concrete guard shacks. The KGB border troops were the age of college sophomores and wore daggers in their belts. They were stunned by the presence of foreigners. A reporter from the Washington Post one day, a Korean computer salesman the next. It seemed to them an invasion, but they were under orders now to let us through. I went to Sakhalin to see if the political reforms going on in Moscow had taken root at the edge of Russia. By the time I got to the island, there had already been an awakening. The first sign of trouble for the local party apparatus came in May 1988, when a few hundred men and women staged a demonstration outside the Chekhov Drama Theater in the capital to accuse the party chief, Pyotr Tretyakov, of doling out apartments to his relatives and generally padding his own patronage rolls. The police and KGB circled the small demonstration, but were too stunned, too confused to act. The party tried to wish it all away. To acknowledge the demonstration would have been a situation. That was impermissible, unthinkable. The next morning, the official papers made the requisite noise about a handful of extremists, then ignored the issue entirely. But soon, as if sensing the Moscow breeze at their backs, the local Democrats staged even bigger demonstrations on the squares and streets of Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk. The island's party leadership was suddenly and unalterably on the defensive. A triumphant banner appeared over Lenin Avenue. "Get rid of the bureaucrats and give them a shovel." Tretyakov, the party chief, would have fought back if he could have, but he got no support from Moscow. He was fired by the Central Committee and fled Sakhalin for Moscow on a military transport jet. He never returned to the island. In the meantime, the new party leaders knew well enough to halt construction of an expensive new headquarters and said they would let the people of Sakhalin decide whether to make a hospital or a school out of the building. In fact, everywhere I went in the Soviet Union in 1989 and 1990, the Communist Party was always in a state of halted construction. Dozens of expensive headquarters never opened, were turned into schools and hospitals, or, more often, sat empty, dark, haunted. This tiny revolution became an instant legend on the island. It was known as the May Events, a distinct echo of the legendary July events that led to the Bolshevik uprising of October 1917. Gorbachev was so pleased with the sign of an awakening in the hinterlands that he told reporters, "Finally, perestroika has come to Sakhalin." But for all of Gorbachev's triumphalism, the party still could not grasp the depths of people's anger with the old structures of power and the hegemony of Moscow. The Central Committee replaced the old apparatchik, Tretyakov, with a new one, Viktor Bondarchuk. Sakhalin Island had to wait only a few months before it showed its opinion of Comrade Bondarchuk. In the race for the Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk seat in the Congress of People's Deputies, an obscure and dyspeptic journalist named Vitaly Guli trounced Bondarchuk. Guli had been an ardent Komsomol boy, dutifully traveling the island preaching ideology. But he had changed radically in the mid-80s. Now in his late 30s, he wrote many of the opinion pieces and embarrassing investigative pieces that led to the May events. One afternoon we rode around in Guli's tiny Moskvich looking for constituents. He wanted to talk with workers about the Congress and the miners' strikes. "I can't exactly say all I need to say in my paper, Sovetsky Sakhalin, so they have to hear it from the horse's mouth." The roads were generally miserable, but suddenly we found ourselves on a strip as fine as a German autobahn. Guli laughed and said, "You want to know why the road is so smooth? This is the road from party headquarters downtown to where all the party big shots had their dachas. They wanted a good road for themselves, and that's all there was to it. Presto, it was built. As for the rest of us..." We headed toward a fishery and caviar processing plant on Freedom Peninsula. To get there, we had to get through yet another KGB checkpoint, which consisted of a crumbling concrete shack, two teenage guards, and a boombox booming, "I saw her standing there." The guard poked his head inside. He asked for our documents. While he checked them over, he was still tapping his foot to the music. "Okay," he said, "we were expecting foreigners. Go ahead through." After I got over my awe at the sight of the caviar, women in white fingering their way through bucketfuls of wondrous slick goo, I could concentrate on how easily Guli mixed with the workers. He had the knack of listening to their complaints, remembering their names, and laughing at their jokes. Many of the workers referred to the first session of the Congress simply as the show, the great show in Moscow, and they wanted to know much more about immediate things, their salaries, housing. One woman told Guli with no embarrassment that the main method of birth control on this island is abortion, and the only way you can get one is to hire a doctor and rent a hotel room. Guli said he would look into the possibility of building a clinic and making birth control available on the island. But there was also a grim understanding between the woman and Vitaly Guli. Only the Communist Party had the power to do anything. And it would do nothing. Guli and his constituents smiled thin smiles at each other and parted. Guli headed for the car, boiling. "Sakharov is right," he said. "I'm a member of the party, but the party has to go. The rest is details." But the party remained, and the party was still all-powerful, especially in a distant province like Sakhalin. The party had rigged the elections so that it could stock the Congress with obedient servants. These were, in the main, dim-witted hacks who had very little idea at all what words like perestroika, glasnost, or democratization meant. Since the days of Stalin, they had been hearing the Kremlin boast of its democracy, its constitutionalism. The constitution written under Stalin, after all, sounds no less glorious than the American version of 1789. but it hardly mattered. Words, much less slogans, had long ago lost their meaning. What really meant something was belonging. Membership in the party apparatus was all. During my stay in Sakhalin, I shuttled back and forth between one host and the other, between Guli and a happy lug named Anatoly Kapustin. Both were deputies in the Congress, but they could not have been more different. Kapustin was elected not by people in his territory, but rather to a seat specially reserved for fellow party and labor union officials. According to the more polite critics in town, he was a time server, a low-rent apparatchik who had worked his way up from the coal mines to a soft office job in the union bureaucracy. He was in no way nasty, and friendlier even than Guli. Kapustin was eager to please. He had a voice like a bassoon and a crushing handshake. He smiled constantly, like a maniac. But now he was in deep trouble. After the triumph of his election, he was having a very bad summer. "Things are out of control," he said, "and that's not good." There had been strikes at the Sakhalin coal mines, and in their aftermath, Kapustin wanted badly to show us that he was working closely with the working class. One morning we watched him try to negotiate his way through a meeting with about 150 miners at union headquarters in Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk. Kapustin did the best he could. He pledged openness like Gorbachev. He chopped the air and rapped the lectern like Gorbachev. But his moves were unconvincing. The poor man was too weighed down by his own meager talents, his dubious resume and election, his habits of thought and speech. He was a cliché, an earnest windbag of the apparat. His new role as a man of perestroika was beyond him. He was no more convincing to the miners than he was to himself. Kapustin was like a dinner theater extra, asked to play Hamlet at the Old Vic with an hour's preparation. He knew some of the lines. "We will work together, hand in hand." But he fooled no one. The miners rolled their eyes and hooted like a flock of owls. Afterward, Kapustin was embarrassed and sad. He thought he was getting it. He thought he'd been brave. "I used to toe the line all the way," he said. "The big guys would say what to do, and I would do it. It was just, Kapustin do this, and that was that. Now I think if something is wrong, I try to speak up." But it wasn't enough. Nearby, in the hallway, one of the strike leaders, Vitali Topolov, said he was trying hard to work with Kapustin, but the prospects were not good at all. I suppose he was an apparatchik, but Gorbachev was an apparatchik under Brezhnev, too. I keep hoping. Kapustin bumbled on. We drove through the hills to Senogorsk, a tiny mining town built by the Japanese when they were in control of the island in 1905. There, in the mine director's office, Kapustin was suddenly at ease. These were his friends, the mid-level bureaucrats who were marginally competent in their jobs, marginally honest. They all regretted the passing of time and apologized for the meager spread of ham sandwiches and fizzy water. "Too bad this isn't the Brezhnev era," one of the mine directors said. "Back then we really would have laid out a banquet for you." It wasn't their arrogance that hampered them so much as their complete lack of comprehension. When it came to simple economics, they could not connect the dots. The mine director complained that production had fallen at the mine by half, but at the same time he launched into a glorious paean to the central planning system and the web of state orders and subsidies. The fact was that his mine was badly equipped, primitive, and probably defunct. It was a dangerous place to work and an ecological disaster, and would never be profitable in a normal economy. After lunch, Kapustin led us on an expedition of the mine, and it was worse than anything I'd seen in Siberia, Ukraine, or Kazakhstan. The mine was a horror. There were no elevators, and the shafts were brutal and tight. It took some of the miners 2 hours of sliding and creeping along stone just to get to their workstations. Later, my back and legs were covered with bruises, and I was more sore than I would have been if I'd run 10 miles. Until the strike, the miners had not been paid for this commuting time. They tore themselves up, 4 hours every day, for free. "And we've taken you down the best mine we've got here," the director said. "This one's dry. In the others, you've got water running down your back all day." Outside, in the daylight at last, Kapustin wiped the soot from his eyes and put on his Gorbachev face again. 2 dozen miners, exhausted and instantly bored, circled around. They wanted to go home, but had been told to wait. "I'm here to listen to your problems," Kapustin said clumsily. "Please, tell me your problems." The men wore the bemused expressions of high school students watching their teacher trying too hard to be hip. They could not wait to go home and soak in a bath. They were in no mood to perform for a union hack like Anatoly Kapustin. And yet, for a few days, I liked him. Kapustin was trying so hard to be admired, and the rewards for toadying were next to nothing. A slightly better salary, a better summer vacation. As a member of the Congress, he was the Soviet equivalent of a congressman, and yet no American, much less a member of the House of Representatives, could have lived the life of Anatoly Kapustin. He lived just about as badly as anyone else in the Soviet Union. A couple of days after our trip to the mine, Kapustin took us out to a huge fishing trawler. I thought we'd get a chance to see how a state boat operated, why it was that so many tons of salmon were rotting in the nets a few hundred feet away. But Kapustin had no interest in that. He was a close friend of the ship captain, and, as Kapustin said, "It's time we kicked back and relaxed. You relax sometimes in America, don't you?" He led us to the captain's stateroom, a wood-paneled affair of surprising elegance. The table was already set with china, decent silverware, dishes heaped with food, and a half-dozen bottles. Georgian champagne, Ukrainian beer, pepper vodka. There was no way out. We were in for a time of it, and I prayed only that the seas would stay calm. Amazingly, Kapustin was a worse drinker than I am. After 3 vodkas, he was expressing his eternal fealty to Yegor Ligachev and the wisdom of the party hardline. The strikes were an outrage, private property impermissible, the independence movements in the Baltic states treason. After just one more drink, he was making horrible sport of Sakharov, calling him self-righteous, anti-Soviet, and useless. "Just who does he think he is?" Kapustin said, his face darkening. "The man talks too much for his own good. He's a slandermonger." It was a nasty performance, and I was, to my surprise, surprised. So many party apparatchiks in so many situations had performed prettily for me, the foreign journalist. But now Kapustin was unbound. The vodka and the days of proximity had worked on him like a key. He was a man who instinctively felt the moral and political threat that Sakharov posed to him and the party. Sakharov and his followers were challenging the very existence of the party, the power of the Kremlin, the way of doing business. "Sakharov and his bunch think we don't understand them," Kapustin said, lifting his glass one last time. "But we do. We understand them. All too well." Chapter 17. Bread and Circuses. When Gibbon wrote the saga of Rome's decline and fall, he relied on the written word, on memoir, epic, and history, for his source material. But the scholars of the collapse of the Soviet Empire will not go to the library so much as the videotape. And in this video revolution, Anatoly Kashpirovsky played the role of Rasputin, the crazy wisdom man. In 1,000 years of Russian history, there have always been healers, mystics, and holy fools. Usually they came to prominence in periods of rapid change, disaster, and disorientation. The 6th-century historian Agathias recalled charlatans and self-appointed prophets roaming the streets after an earthquake in Byzantium. Society, he wrote, never fails to throw up a bewildering variety of such persons in times of misfortune. In the last years of the Tsarist regime, Rasputin, an illiterate Siberian, convinced the Romanovs of his magical powers. The royal family was sure Rasputin was curing the heir to the throne of his hemophilia. But while Rasputin's mesmerizing influence was limited to the Tsar's family and high society, Kashpirovsky was a man of the global village and the world tour. His healing seances captured television audiences of 300 million in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and filled huge concert halls and football stadiums. Kashpirovsky's medicine show had been kicking around for years. But it was at the end of 1989, when the economy was plummeting and people began talking about a new time of troubles, that the Communist Party officials who ran state television decided it was time for a grand diversion, a video healer. I saw the first of Kashpirovsky's broadcasts, and, like everybody else, I was hooked from the opening credits. A logo announced the teleseance. Kashpirovsky came on the screen, dressed all in black. He had the hyped-up glare, the scissors and a bowl haircut of Brando in Julius Caesar. He started talking about his method of reaching the biocomputer inside his patients, how he had healed hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people, of their tumors, hernias, and heart pains. His voice was 16 RPM, low and even, like a threat. He claimed medical successes never known in human history, successful cures of impotence, frigidity, blindness, baldness, emphysema, ovarian cysts, kidney stones, psoriasis, eczema, varicose veins, scars, tuberculosis, asthma, diabetes, allergies, stuttering, astigmatism, and in 4 documented cases, the AIDS virus. He was at once God and Ponce de Leon. Amputated limbs and extracted teeth regenerated at his mere suggestion. Gray hair turned glossy and dark. Thanks to him, a woman of 70 began menstruating again, and Mikhail Gorbachev's mother got over her arthritis. And then there was the Kashpirovsky diet. One of his patients dropped 350 pounds, and without the skin hanging off or anything. Or so the doctor said. So he said. The soundtrack picked up now. A great wash of synthesizer music switched on Baroque. "Rid your mind of everything," Kashpirovsky purred. "Get rid of all those goals and ambitions. Everyone, close your eyes. No matter what emotional reactions you have, don't suppress them. And you will have different kinds of emotional reactions. Our silence is like a pause without words. Words don't matter. There's no work involved in this. It's hard to understand because all their lives people have been taught to try and understand. Forget everything. Listen to the music. Don't be afraid of the process that's starting within you. If something is moving, pay no attention." The man seemed never to blink. He glistened, and for long periods he said nothing, just stared and smirked a little, the way a tyrant dinner guest does when he is half-soused and certain you should be fascinated by everything he says. "Some of you are seeing forests, mountains. 1, 2, 3. Others are having very sad memories. 5, 6. Others are making plans for tomorrow, weighing everything. 7. By 10, Kashpirovsky was gone. "The seance," he said, "is over." we were healed. Since his first televised seances, Kasparovsky's popularity, his cult of personality, went unmatched. Everyone knew his name and thought him either a genius or a confidence man. He told me once that he had an archive of more than 1 million telegrams and letters, mainly from grateful viewer patients. Schoolgirls and pensioners wrote in, hinting they would do anything to be near him, learn from him, sleep with him. Older women wrote saying they had redecorated their Krasny Ugol, Red Corner, by taking down the traditional portrait of Lenin and replacing it with his. In the provinces, street vendors sold picture postcards of Tsar Nicholas II, John Lennon, Jesus Christ, and Anatoly Kasparovsky. He may have been the only man in the city of Kiev with 3 cars in his garage and a bank account to match. Newspapers that debunked his legend did so at their peril. After the weekly Literaturnaya Gazeta printed an article calling Kasparovsky a dangerous charlatan, the protest mail grew into such an avalanche that the editor cancelled a second article. There were those who thought of Kasparovsky as a healer not only of stretch marks and wens, but of nations as well, and he was loath to dismiss the claim. "If I were president, people would kiss my footprints after I died because I would go out among the people and work for their interests," he told me. His constituency was uncertain, but he insisted it was vast. "Ukraine is too small for me." Kasparovsky first appeared on the scene with a series of 6 nationally televised seances in the last few months of 1989. With the rise of independence movements and a workers' revolt, perestroika was spinning out of Gorbachev's control. The healthcare system was a shambles, with officials saying that only 30% of all basic medicines were available. Even aspirin and penicillin were impossible to find. There were constant reports of hospitals without running water, doctors operating by candlelight. Kasparovsky's rise came precisely at the start of this extreme uncertainty, confusion, spiritual search. And, as happened so often in Russian history, disruption gave rise to an increased interest in black magic, prophecy, and wizardry. Bogoyskoe Telstvo, the search for God, in Russia, led not only to the church, mosque, and synagogue, but to such frauds as Rasputin and Kasparovsky. Always, even during the purges, there were village healers and mystics in Russia. In his dotage, Leonid Brezhnev secretly invited the healer, Juna Davitashvili, to the Kremlin to work her magic. But now there were no taboos, no hiding. During the Gorbachev era, old women sold copper bracelets in city parks, swearing they would work as a vaccine against AIDS. Horoscopes ran in Communist Party newspapers. The official news agency TASS announced that human-like giants and a midget robot flying in a banana-shaped object had landed in the city of Voronezh. Witnesses described the craft in question as a large shining ball, and the 1, 2, or 3 creatures as being 3 or 4 meters high, but with very small heads. In Moscow, a healer named Alan Chumak opened shop on the program 120 Minutes, the Soviet version of the Today Show. Waving his hands as if he were petting an invisible cat, Chumak charged glasses of water and tubes of cold cream that people put in front of their television sets with healing energy. "I am in touch with another world," Chumak told me. He dug his hand into a garbage bag and pulled out one of his countless telegrams. "Sincerely grateful, stop. Had chronic tachycardia and gastritis, stop. Doctors couldn't cure me, stop. Now, thanks to you, I live without medicine, stop. Thanks. Sergei of Novocherkassk." I followed Chumak as he rode the elevator downstairs and stepped out into his building's parking lot to heal a crowd of a few hundred people. This was a bi-weekly event, weather-depending. A big crowd had gathered. Some of the people held up pictures of their sick children or parents, in hopes that the healer could radiate his energy through the photographic medium. Chumak stood on the steps and invited all to gather around and feel his aura. He had only one warning. He could not cure any former functionaries of the Communist Party. "Their souls are already too hardened," he said. Kasparovsky, of course, regarded Chumak as a quack, and himself as above all this common magic. He was the Uber-doctor, a secular priest of mind and body. "I've outgrown the title of doctor," he said one night backstage before a séance. "That's child's play. It's not healing. I have a great idea. But I'm not pushing religion. What good does it do if Jesus walked on water 2,000 years ago? What does it do for these people?" He rubbed his chin and wondered where his marvelous gift came from. "The spiritual power that drove Jesus Christ very possibly exists within me," he said, "and in 50 years I think I will be remembered as a saint." Kasparovsky trained as a psychologist in Vinnytsia, a provincial city in Ukraine, and worked in a hospital there for 28 years. He earned a tiny salary, and, to earn 100 rubles a month extra, he worked at night loading trucks with cement and lumber. For a while he was a fanatical weightlifter and boxer, and even now, in his early 50s, he was physically vain, claiming, "I can beat any champion of the world." But in 1975, Kasparovsky said, he had severe pancreatic disorders and nearly died. He spent a year in a hospital in Ukraine and then decided to go to Sakhalin, where he wandered the island, like St. John the Baptist, eating one cookie a day. "Thanks to my hunger," he said, "I was cured." It was only in 1988 that Kasparovsky began his public experiments in hypnosis and mass healing. He held 5 teleseances in Kiev, and, he claimed, cured thousands of children of bedwetting. His technique was as obscure then as now, a talking cure in which the healer somehow sets the right organic balance of the body. Happiness and sadness have some sort of material basis, biochemical substances behind them. When I am afraid, I have a lot of adrenaline. When I'm depressed, I have more, he said, beginning a lecture of sorts. The gates open up inside of you and you accept information. You don't know how those gates open. That's my method. The information comes in. But because you don't know how it comes in, it can't get out. I reach beyond the mind into the innermost being to heal the body. The mark is left. In 1988, the head of Soviet television was Mikhail Nenashev, a doltish apparatchik who told his aides that the primary aim of television was to soothe and reassure the troubled masses. In Kasparovsky, who had strong support from people high up in the Ukrainian Communist Party organization, Nenashev found his soothing and reassuring voice. He signed him up for séances that were broadcast in 1989 not only in the Soviet Union, but in Bulgaria, Poland, Israel, Czechoslovakia, and Scandinavia. "In a country where you can't even find aspirin, you begin hoping for a miracle," said Yelena Chikolova, a television critic for Moscow News. "Then along comes this man, and he offers you an easy way out, a miracle. It's a phenomenon inherent in a poor and miserable country." Leonid Parfionov, a well-known broadcaster, said, "Kasparovsky's role has been similar to Gorbachev's role in 85 and 86. They even have common gestures. They both come up with tremendous patches of meaninglessness in their speeches, and yet they were mesmerizing and inspired confidence." Kasparovsky's most theatrical bit of psychic trickery came in a telebridge between Kiev and the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. A woman named Lesya Yershova needed a major abdominal operation at a Tbilisi hospital. Rejecting ordinary anesthesia, she allowed Kasparovsky to hypnotize her, via television from Kiev. The resulting tape, a split-screen extravaganza, was grotesque.
Just close your eyes and sing the poplar tree, Kasparovsky tells the poor woman. The poor woman actually squeezes out a few wobbly notes.
Close your eyes. You're floating, Kasparovsky says. You have no pain from your stomach to your spine. Close those eyes. Yes, yes, you do feel the surgical instruments in your body. But you feel normal. Soon everything will be all right. People will ask me later if you are asleep. Are you?
No, she says meekly. I feel someone doing something to my body.
Indeed they are. The operation requires a 40-centimeter incision. When it is over, Kasparovsky tells the audience, Now all of you who have watched me can go to the dentist and get a tooth pulled. There will be no pain at all. I assure you.
Kasparovsky claimed he had made medical, no, spiritual, history with that performance. But then the patient rebelled. Lesya Yashova told reporters that, in fact, she had been in monstrous pain during the operation and had cooperated only because she didn't want to let Kasparovsky down. Yuri Savenko, the president of the Independent Psychiatric Association, said the Ministry of Health's cooperation in Kasparovsky's broadcasts was an outrage and part of a broader bread-and-circuses conspiracy engineered by the Communist Party. He was far from alone in believing that the party was using the broadcasts to divert the attentions and sorrows of the people. With the Russian people, he said, Christianity is superficial. They are largely pagan. They observe rituals without understanding the essence. Under the political situation today, mysticism increases, and with such a low cultural level, it acquires outrageous forms. Savenko said that one of his colleagues had firm data proving that Kasparovsky's seances had not only done nothing to heal people of their ills, they also caused some Russians to have psychotic episodes. But there was no investigation. Journalists and doctors alike had a difficult time attacking a figure so popular that he won Man of the Year honors in various newspapers in 1990, and had a following no politician or movie star could match. Savenko said that some of his psychologist and psychiatrist friends were reduced to pranks. I know some people made fun of Kasparovsky by sending him cables saying things like, Thanks to you, my amputated stump has grown 5 centimeters longer. Then they waited for him to read them out in public as a testimonial. On tour, Kasparovsky packed concert halls, factory courtyards, and even soccer stadiums. His video cassettes were passed hand to hand the way Solzhenitsyn's manuscripts once were. In the provinces, where very few people had VCRs, video salons and movie theaters organized Kasparovsky nights and showed the great man's tapes. As a businessman, he was not altogether happy with this underground trafficking. At the beginning of one tape put together in the United States, the usual FBI warning that it is a crime to copy the tape dissolved into Kasparovsky's own message. Warning. Duplicating this tape will result in losing its medical properties. I saw Kasparovsky in Moscow and on his world tour in the West. It was always the same scene, a mix of spooky New Age and Beatlemania. One night in New York, at a school in the Pelham Parkway section of the Bronx, Kasparovsky hid in a corner, trying to avoid the stares of the bulky, perfumed émigré babushkas as they filed into the auditorium. The healer was in an awful mood. A few nights before in Queens, he had had a good time of it. The adulation level was just right. "I believe in you like a god," one woman told him. Someone should blow up your enemies. Thank God that you were delivered to us. You are a god on earth. Another man threw away his cane and started limping joyously around the apron of the stage, yelping his thanks in Russian. Kasparovsky accepted all this as his due. He feigned boredom. Sure, there was a cult of Kasparovsky, Kasparovsky allowed. But it wasn't as if I'm going to tell them to blow up a nuclear power station. You shouldn't be afraid of a repeat of Stalin or something. But now Kasparovsky wore the collapsed look of the doomed. He was sure everything would go wrong. His manager, Mikhail Zimmerman, darted around like a wasp, frantic to know why the microphone crackled with static, why his star was so riddled with gloom. "Anatoly Mikhailovich is like a great instrument," Zimmerman said. "Sometimes he is just not in tune." Kasparovsky was feeling the despair of all self-declared prophets. The world, the very universe, was not prepared for his wonderfulness. "Humankind is not ready yet to be saved," he said. "There is not yet the technique. Imagine that everyone is healthy, no one is dying, and people keep reproducing. Where will they go? The other planets aren't inhabitable yet. It's some kind of law." Once he was on stage, Kasparovsky gave it a valiant try, but never caught the groove. Never mind the inadequate universe. Hell, as Robert Frost said, is a half-filled auditorium. He was angry at the middling ticket sales. He was used to 300 million on TV and 25,000 live. And now he had 300 if he was lucky. He recited his accomplishments and theories with all the tricked-up enthusiasm of a guy selling toupees on late-night television. Then the testimonials began. A woman's neck no longer had its crick. Hallelujah! Another woman's rheumatism was gone. Her gray hair had darkened. "I feel like 30, not 60," she said. She looked 70. Kasparovsky hardly acknowledged the miracles he had wrought. He had his eye on the clock on the back wall, and after a decent interval, he declared it time for the real seance, the synthesizer music and the purring into the microphone, the healing. But even this, his centerpiece, wilted. As he strolled up and down the aisle, Kasparovsky spotted people who had not closed their eyes, others who fidgeted in their seats. "Don't look at me!" he shouted at one woman. "You're irritating me! Turn away from me!" As he turned away, the music swelled, and Kasparovsky reddened. "Where did you get that music?" he barked at his assistant at the mixing board. "This is not human music. This is the sort of music they..."